the reverse. Some children are very sensitive to tone and emphasis in speech, but most need explanations, examples, and plenty of practice to understand the myriad complexities of everyday conversations. The generous and practical way to parent is to remember that your child is new to this world, this culture, our habits. With some patient guidance, she'll likely be able to learn everything she needs to communicate with sensitivity and grace. Fathers and daughters. 10-year-old girl. Dad, did you know that ants never sleep? Father. Really? Where did you hear that? Girl. I don't remember, but I know it's true. Father laughs, high-fives her. Fathers teach a different set of communication skills than mothers do. Moms model listening for emotional nuance and offer solace and guidance. Dads toughen girls up, teach them how to take a joke, and talk to them about things that are outside the personal social realm in which women and girls are so absorbed. As children grow, the value of dad's contribution continues. Fathers use a less familiar vocabulary than do mothers, but because the words are used in context and children appreciate that dad is spending time with them, the kids are motivated to figure out what he means and keep the conversation going. As fathers and daughters talk about business or sports or what's happening outside the car window, girls learn the meaning of terms like gridlock, where's the grid, and colleague, sounds like collie. The definition of slam dunk, the words needed to narrate a shared road trip, pit stop, slipstream, thunderheads. Obviously, mothers also have vast and fascinating troves of knowledge. They have colleagues and watch sports, too. But because dad-daughter conversations are less often hijacked by the business of the girls' schedules and activities, the topics of their conversations tend to cover different terrain. The exposure to a wider vocabulary is only a small part of what a father contributes to his daughter's ability to engage with other people. Growing accustomed to his conversational rhythm and style and learning what to make of his nonverbal cues and playful teasing is her foundation. Talking to, playing with, and being quiet beside dad gives a girl practice in what lies ahead. Creating harmony with or standing up to men on teams, at work, in friendship, in love relationships, and with her own sons. Where mom protects her daughter's vulnerability, dad sees her strengths and aims to endow her with more. Fathers bolster a girl's persistence and pride by challenging her and having high expectations. Dads teach girls how to manage bigger risks, including physical risks. They're often the ones pushing their daughters to take a few more chances on the playing field or to go ahead and jump into their arms in the cold lake. Daughters need that toughening up to be ready for a world of competition. Dads also teach daughters the nuances of when it's worth it to break a rule and when it's not. Mothers typically prefer their children, especially daughters, to be more conservative. This goes back to neurochemistry and brain architecture. Girls are rule followers and pleasers. They're generally more hesitant than boys to step outside the lines. Fathers can give girls practice speaking up, challenging an idea, refusing to do something that goes against their nature or values. A girl can give her dad a hard time and he'll get mad, maybe shout at or punish her, and she'll survive. Moms get alarmed by the yelling and want to defend the daughter against this boogeyman. But the boogeyman she knows and loves is the one who can teach her how to stand up to overbearing or threatening characters she'll encounter later in life. Fathers today are ambitious for their daughters. They might not be able to name the best third grade teacher, but they want to raise young women who can be independent and compete. And they know instinctively that developing nerve and resilience is crucial to their girl survival. Pearls for Fathers. When I was a little girl, my father always greeted a friend of mine, even if she had been over the day before, by saying, "Is that Shirley Capelli herself? Did I say you could come here?" Shirley always responded with a giggle, "I'm here to play with Wendy." My dad is a natural with children, and when I parse the elements of his verbal welcome today, it's obvious why it put a guest at ease. First, he knew Shirley's full name, as he did the names of all of my friends. That was a sign of respect. Second, he was playfully reminding us that he was king of this castle and would be keeping an eye on the place. That made us feel safe. Finally, his faux tough guy teasing demonstrated that he knew we could take some kidding around. To this day, when I phone my dad, he asks in a tone of incredulity and glee, "Is this Dr. Wendy Mogul herself?" I never tire of this game, or of his playfulness and pride in me. Once he thought my sister was calling, so I got to hear a different version. "Is this sweet, sweet Jane herself?" We'll leave that family dynamic for another book. From my work with parents and children, I've collected a few techniques like this that fathers can use to nourish their bond with their daughters. Remember the first and last names of her close friends, along with some physical identifiers. You'll get bonus points if you remember the initials that go along with the popular names. Is that Ella M or Ella B? Under-promise and over-deliver about attending events. Unless you're certain that you will be able to attend an event, do not say you'll be there. Also, don't say you'll try to make it if there's any chance you won't. Instead, say that you will not be able to attend, tell her why, and then, if possible, show up. Your daughter will be thrilled. Take her on father-daughter errands and trips. Short trips to the grocery or hardware store are ideal talking-while-doing opportunities for dads and daughters, who may not have as many activities in common as fathers and sons. For the gold standard, take her on a road trip. Nothing, not the fanciest four-star resort, is as valuable as a road trip. Just a dad and his daughter cruising down the highway, vying for control of the music, eating in dubious cafes, zoning out to the scenery, drifting into nonsensical or heartfelt conversations. Earbuds, not welcome. It's a luxury to have so much time that a portion of it can be spent in companionable silence. Destinations can be landmarks, historic places, or the neighborhood and haunts of your boyhood. Another idea, the setting of a book she's read in school. After my daughter read Huckleberry Finn, my husband took her on a trip along the Mississippi River. Praise her stamina, courage, enthusiasm, and curiosity, characteristics that are not her physical appearance. A father's uncritical gaze is a blessing to his daughter, especially because mothers are so attuned to the girl's personal grooming. The less a father comments on his daughter's looks, the more relaxed she'll be in his presence. He can then notice and share her other worthy attributes. Certainly, if she's in a new party dress, or it's a special day, or she's in a costume or other creative attire, your exuberant appreciation will enhance the spirit of the occasion. What rare beauty do we have here? Otherwise, dads do best by keeping comments about their daughter's appearance to a minimum. One word of caution for dads. Be aware of the power of secondhand messages. Let's say you've overcome your disappointment that she wasn't a son, or you're wildly relieved, and you never criticize her appearance because you know that popular culture sends destructive messages leading women to believe that their worth lies in their looks. And it's easy not to let criticism slip out because your daughter is always beautiful in your eyes, and you're convinced that her potential is unlimited. Stay alert. What your daughter overhears is as powerful as what you say to her directly. A father can undermine a thoughtful agenda of female empowerment by habitually speaking critically to or about his daughter's mother within her hearing, or commenting on the appearance of female family members or women in the public eye. Even as I write this, I want to stop myself, speak for dads, and say, give me a break. An occasional snarky crack about a frumpy local politician is not going to doom my daughter's future relationships with men. But I'm not backing down, because monitoring yourself for the overheard is simply another level of consciousness raising, an easily overlooked aspect of the power of a father's words. Goodwill in girl world. When you're not arguing with your daughter, the door to enchantment swings open, and behold, girlhood in all its chaotic glory. Goodwill for daughters has much to do with simple acceptance, just being along for the ride, and making sure they know you're loving it and you approve. Young girls are bursting with devotion to objects and people adults find ordinary or baffling. They start sentences with, "Oh my God," at younger and younger ages. One mother recounted how her 9-year-old daughter Rose had been assigned a big science project. "I was pleased to come home after work and see lots of books open on the dining room table. Maps taped to the wall, and long handwritten lists. I told Rose, 'Wow, this looks great. I can see you've made a lot of progress on your volcano project.' She says, 'This isn't my volcano project. This is my itinerary for our honeymoon.' Rose is obsessed with Justin Bieber. 'See this map, Mom? First, we're going to fly to Maui. Now see this list? It's our plan. When we get to the hotel, we unpack, then we go straight to the bar to have champagne and watch the sunset.' Volcanoes, Hawaii, honeymoon with Justin Bieber. It makes perfect sense. Garner some goodwill by daydreaming about the vacation getaway with her for a few moments before directing her back to the science project. With boys, you're an anthropologist visiting a strange country, learning about its rituals and esoteric facts. With girls, you're a sociologist. To fill the goodwill coffers, you need only listen to her describe her world. Little girls are experts at analyzing social structures. You're spellbound and patient, and you have lots of tolerance even for gossip, silliness, and the granular details of her special third-grade universe. Girls will espouse all kinds of stereotypes and assumptions that are wrong, but take care not to move in quickly to capture teachable moments. Appreciate the drama of her narratives. You're not looking for things to fix or improve. You're just observing and occasionally asking for clarification about concerns too subtle or confounding for your adult perspective. Being your daughter's enthusiastic audience and letting her have control over her hair, clothes, and food will keep the goodwill account solidly funded. Here are a few other ways to cherish her. Give her somewhere to roam free. Girls need free play as much as boys do, for all the same reasons, and for one that is specific to their gender. It's how they can learn the boundaries between risk and danger, so difficult for parents to even consider in relation to their daughters. I'm a strong proponent of sending children away for a few weeks in the summer, either to a relative's house or to camp. You'll have to size up your daughter's readiness based on her eagerness to sleep at a friend's house, how well she does on school trips, and her overall enthusiasm for parent-free adventure. Try to enroll her in a program where part of each day is unstructured. Scheduling learning camps right after school, right after the structured family vacation, will not provide her with the loose, lazy time she needs to find her own bearing. The happy news is that some day camps are becoming more flexible, to the point where children are permitted to participate on random days without being enrolled for a specific program. They offer a place where kids can do creative, messy, unstructured activities. This type of freedom may cause you to feel that you're depriving your daughter of necessary skill-building opportunities or that you're being neglectful. If so, find one other parent who shares your values and it will help put you at ease. Let her teach you tech, especially dads. Bonding over technology can be a good thing for parents and daughters. Yes, it's more screen time, and there should be limits set. But if girls and their fathers are having a hard time finding activities they both enjoy, watching a movie or TV show, playing video games, or tinkering with robotics may fit the bill. If your daughter isn't into building vehicles and actual robots, there are kits that let her build dollhouses, bunnies, Lego creations of all sorts, clocks, and much more, all with programmable pieces. Go for a long walk or hike with her. Leave your phone at home or in the car and tell her you're leaving it. Walking outdoors, especially in parks or other wild or wooded areas, opens the floodgates of conversation and builds respect as only uninterrupted time together can. It says to a child, "You are worthy of my undivided attention." Being outdoors has other advantages as well. The greater number of senses and the more physical movement involved, the more likely an experience will be etched in your child's memory. The smell of the wet earth, the texture of moss, tiny flowers, mushrooms, how the wind almost blew your jacket away. Hiking together will give her adventures to describe and will add to her storehouse of happy family memories. When you're on a path or nature trail, let your daughter choose which fork to follow. Even on a walk in the neighborhood, you can ask, "Which way next? You lead." Plant and tend a garden. All you need is a few square feet for a vegetable garden or a patch of flowers. Flower bulbs look so plain, like a root vegetable. But plant them, water, wait, and a tulip or ranunculus emerges. Delight in that oddity of vocabulary, ranunculus, a word that combines the sounds of uncle and ridiculous. Tending a garden may well be your child's first experience with delayed gratification. What a tremendous payoff. Watch your daughter's face as she introduces a friend to her flowers or offers a taste of the first cherry tomatoes plucked from the vine. Bake together. This is valuable currency for both sons and daughters, but young girls are more likely to have fine motor and reading skills to follow recipes. As mentioned in the last chapter, boys old enough to responsibly handle flames and knives, love to cook. There's so much to learn from baking. The unique lexicon of the art. Sift, grease, brown, knead. The visual acuity needed to gauge when a pancake is ready to flip or a cookie is just golden enough. Not to mention frosting and decorating the finished product. Hand in hand while you can. It's a hot Sunday on a crowded street. A small girl catches my eye because of the confidence of her stride. She's wearing black boots, a lime green skirt, and a black sweatshirt. I sense that her mother didn't argue with her about her outfit. It's going to be hot today. Black clothes are, boots are. The child clearly loves these boots and wears them every day, and her mother chooses to let her choose. Instead of holding hands, they each hold the end of a pencil, no doubt at the daughter's suggestion. The girl speaks. I never, never, never want to go back there. Never. She is not whining, but stating a preference as strong as her stride. I don't like it there. Mother, speaking in a calm, matter-of-fact, amiable way. You don't like the farmer's market. We only need a few things, then we'll leave. I could easily imagine why she didn't like it. She'd have to maneuver between the forest of knees of a bunch of grown-ups. She's too close to the ground to see any of the vendors' displays, and she and her mom would probably have to switch from their playful pencil linkage to ordinary holding of hands. But mostly, I was struck by the mother's reaction. She simply acknowledged her daughter's point of view and didn't try to change her mind by selling the current or future attributes of the errand. We'll get to make peach pie this afternoon. Or bribe her. Or say, it's not so bad. So many mothers I see are naturals at the art of conversation with daughters. Many more are just a few notches away, a few degrees of tamping down the anxiety and turning up the tolerance and curiosity. I often think of a little girl in a pink tutu I once passed on a dusty hiking trail. She was crouching by the side of the trail, collecting rocks in the tutu skirt, while her mother stood next to her, not commenting, just listening and nodding, while the girl exclaimed, "These all have stripes." That was a mother who deserved a gold star. It was an ordinary moment, one neither of them might remember. But I will, because I know how soon that girl will race ahead on the trail. Hold her hand now. Slow your pace a bit and learn how to talk with her while she's young, and you'll have her trust and friendship in all the years ahead. Chapter 5. Hard Topics. Talking to young children about sex, death, and money. Mom, what is this fish doing here? This fish has two black stripes and a circle around only one eye. Where is Goldie? Did Goldie die, Mom? She did, and you're lying. But you always say not to lie. But why are they called privates? Like private school? Are we rich? Is Zachary's family rich? Who's richer? We have two dogs, but they have a slide in their backyard. In times that now seem as ancient as a rotary telephone, children's serious questions about sex, death, and money were ignored or met with bizarre, formulaic responses. Babies were dropped off by storks. Providing nuanced or honest information about sexual feelings and activity was considered risky. Knowing would lead to doing, which would lead to trouble. If a relative died, children might be told that he or she had gone on a long trip or that God wanted another angel. Money fell into a special category. Discussing it was taboo for reasons never explained beyond it's not polite. These forbidden zones deprive children of essential knowledge and parents of the opportunity to pass on their values and join in conversations about life's richest and most thrilling subjects. Nowadays, parents are less squeamish, but not necessarily more forthcoming. Where previous generations had an evasive laissez-faire attitude toward sex, death, and money, today's parents are paralyzed. They recognize that a casual brush-off is both depriving and dangerous, but their fear of saying the wrong thing and having their child repeat it, setting off a cascade of outrage from the school or other parents, stymies them. Parents are also afraid that if they allow their children to express the depths of their feelings or be exposed to ideas that are provocative, vivid, or sad, the kids will be frightened. Yet, the opposite is true. Once children have talked about these mysteries with their parents, they are no longer as alone with the monsters under the bed. Children have always taken joy in the sensual. Ah, warm, squishy mud between my toes, pulling on my penis like a toy I never have to look for. So fun. They're fascinated with body systems. When the baby grows in the mommy's tummy, how does it eat? Does it poop in there? They're riveted by the cycle of life and death. Goldie, Grandpa, Milo's mom? They're determined and curious. So if parents don't tackle these topics with readiness and aplomb, the children will be left to rely on less scrupulous sources. They'll eventually see sex through the harsh lens of online pornography or clinical, scare tactic, sex ed classes. Death will be revealed via superhero movies and video games, which teach that killing your adversaries is both cool and kind of fun. They'll learn to crave goods and services from our consumer culture while remaining ignorant about how money actually works. All this, in addition to the normal misinformation that's been traded among peers from the beginning of time. Every parent's conversational repertoire needs to include a way of speaking comfortably about the uncomfortable topics. There are excellent books that can do some of the heavy lifting for you, but ultimately, your child will turn to you for answers, both philosophical and practical. In all discussions about emotionally charged issues, a light touch will bring you to depth. Stay open, listen carefully, and let your child's questions be your guide. How much do children understand? As soon as children can speak, they'll catch you off guard with questions that leave you groping for answers that are true yet not alarming. As they grow older, you'll get a sense of how they process information and the best approach for your particular son or daughter. Between the ages of 4 and 11, children experience tremendous cognitive development, and your answers will evolve along with them. But, and this is crucial, the answers do not have to be perfect. Part of the parental anxiety that is so pervasive today has to do with what I call AP parenting. The notion that every decision has to be the right one, that we can't possibly come back to a child and say, you know, I've been thinking about what I told you yesterday, and I have a better answer. Or, I gave it a little more thought, and that's not exactly how I feel. This flexible approach is a terrific model children can use with their own friends. You're allowed to change your mind. It's also the only approach that's realistic with a little person whose perceptions and comprehension changes almost weekly. Even if a parent is aware of the general milestones of cognitive development, a child's ability to grasp information is never a sure thing. Consider the variables. There's the child's age and gender, the depth of his interest in the scientific side of things, or the gory, artistic, spiritual, or common sense side, the length of his attention span, what's provoked a question in the first place, and whether the question he's asking is what he really wants to know. Children sometimes come up with convoluted queries that have little connection to what's actually on their minds. If you're relaxed about the questions, if you're curious and calm, your child will eventually get around to the heart of the matter. For example, whether he could be arrested for stealing a bag of chips from someone's lunchbox. Stages of cognitive development in children. Many parents are aware of basic cognitive development in babies, for instance, the concept of object permanence. A newborn stares blankly at your game of peekaboo. A few months later, she's astonished and delighted by it. Between 8 and 12 months, the thrill is gone. She's figured out that objects continue to exist even if she can't see them. Other milestones are not as obvious. Deborah Rothman is a health educator and author of Uncommon Wisdom. See the recommended readings for her titles and other books I regularly suggest to parents about subjects that typically cause nervousness or inhibition. She poetically describes a cognitive achievement that marks the emergence from infancy to very early childhood. I am not one with the whole universe, not one with my parents. Humans are objects that begin and end. We exist in space as separate beings. This recognition naturally brings protest. Wah! I don't want you to leave me in this room all alone. But it also liberates. If I hide in the closet and don't move, or in the center of a round rack of clothing at the mall, no one can see me. Wow. By the age of 5, most children understand that time begins and ends. They understand the past best because they've had some experience with it. The future is still an abstraction. Very soon, soon, tomorrow, a long time. These words are slower to provide reassurance to a child who is eager or worried about what lies ahead. By age 6, children grow in their ability to understand distance in a deeper way. Some are fascinated with the concept of movement over time, with locomotion and transportation. These milestones concerning space, time, and distance are good to keep in mind when gauging your child's reactions, especially to unusual or traumatic events. Whatever your particular child's understanding of these concepts, they are different from your own, and for that reason, you can't assume that what a child hears is exactly what you meant. This is another reason it's helpful to be able to say, I've been thinking this over, and I had some ideas about our conversation from the other day. Let's talk about it some more. Not one talk, but many. Once parents make up their minds to tackle a difficult topic, they sometimes try to explain the whole story, including all the precise mechanics, in one intense session. Phew, got that over with. This doesn't work because children have short attention spans and limited capacity to take in new concepts and language. They can't absorb that much in a single gulp. No matter what the age of the child, he or she won't remember the information if you download it all at once. Even the brightest student will forget the details of a subject that is confusing, embarrassing, or Gross. This is a fundamental point to remember when dealing with any complex subject. There's no such thing as the talk. There is the first talk and then many more talks. A better approach is to patiently answer your child's questions as they arise as often as necessary. Sometimes you'll be busy with another activity or unsettled because you're in foreign territory. You never would have asked such a question of your parents or any adult. You may be afraid of saying the wrong thing, unsure about the best response. It's always appropriate to say, "That is a fine question." Children respond well to emphatic declarations. "I need a little time to think about the best answer, so I'll get back to you," and then do it, lest your child conclude that certain topics are off limits. Saying, "Let me think about it," also saves you from impulsively responding in a jokey, mocking, or nervous manner, and allows you to acknowledge and settle down with your own discomfort. When discussing sensitive subjects, you'll travel together on the slow road. The conversations will be more effective if they aren't formal, lengthy, or preachy. Your child will come to see you as a trusty resource if you greet her queries in a welcoming manner and provide answers that are specific and brief. You can always ask, "What were you wondering? Tell me what you already know, so I'll know where to start." Here's where you get to correct misperceptions. "I'm not surprised to hear that. A lot of people think that way, but actually..." "Interesting. How did you hear about that? Are you curious about anything else? Does my answer make sense to you?" It's your curriculum. Concerning sex education and the other provocative topics, don't assume the schools will give more than the most basic explanations. Most sex ed programs focus on disease and pregnancy prevention. The curriculum tends to be either two forms of protection is magic number, one for avoiding disease, one for avoiding pregnancy, or abstinence is the only sure path. Teachers are discouraged from exploring many subjects that might be controversial for fear that doing so will alarm a subset of parents and cause trouble for the administration. Intimacy and love, the precious and finite nature of all life, the relationship between money, class mobility, and success, these compelling issues get neglected in most classrooms. In one regard, this is good. It gives you the chance to educate your child on some fascinating subjects, to transmit your values, to keep up with changing times. But like all homeschooling parents, you'll have to prepare. This means taking a personal inventory. What painful experiences from your own childhood might lead you to be overprotective or paranoid about your child's normal actions and questions, or his naive but age-appropriate beliefs? What do you need to learn in order to raise a wise child in an ever-changing world? While answering your child's questions gives you a sense of what he's capable of comprehending, you don't have to wait for a query to open a line of discussion. Food for thought is everywhere. Drive in the car or ride the bus, and billboards send messages to your child about body image, sexuality, drinking, illness, homelessness. If you catch your child staring at one of these, you can ask, "What's on your mind?" Watching TV, movies, or videos, and the ads give you an opportunity to teach media literacy. Recognition that many advertisers put profit over people's welfare. If information reaches your child through the internet, you can explain that the motives of people who create web content are to attract viewers' attention, even if the message is not fair, kind, or true. A stroll down the sidewalks of most cities will challenge you to discuss the range of people you see, including the elderly, people in wheelchairs, families who are fighting in public. You may not be able to answer your child's toughest questions about these people or displays, but you can be open to the dialogue. Another skill you'll get to teach while out in the real world is public etiquette. Every child has loudly uttered some version of, "Why is that lady fat?" Or, "Why is your skin brown and your mom's is white?" Without shaming your child, you can let her know there's a difference between things we ask about at home and what we say in public. When children are very young, you can help them understand when not to comment by making the boundary simple. It's not polite to say anything about how someone looks or acts unless you're saying what you like about it. When your child gets older, you can add some context. We don't want to embarrass people or put them on the spot or hurt their feelings. For instance, Uncle Sal may always be saying he wants to lose weight, but it still isn't polite to remind him that he's already eaten 2 hot dogs. Be prepared for your child's unintentional gaffes by agreeing on a code, such as pulling on an earlobe that means stop talking right now. I'll explain later. You don't want to embarrass her, but you do want to raise her consciousness. Good manners are about protecting other people's dignity, and that's an abstract concept. Teaching it will take some time. Buy the book, a first stop for hard topics. What kind of sticky issues will your child lay at your feet? Things like, "Noah told me he got laid with Scarlett." "How come Addie is allowed to sleep here, but you always say no to sleepovers at her house? It's not fair. It's really fun at her house. Her parents are nice, and her brother's friends are really smart because they're in 7th grade." "August said that Jackson's dad might have to go to jail. He said that the dad tried to kill himself already." "Lucy's mom has no hair on her head anymore, or any eyebrows or eyelashes. She was wearing a scarf, but you could tell." "Grandpa Mark will be home from the hospital before my school's open house, right? He has to see my painting. The boat looks like it's really far away in the ocean. Grandpa Mark showed me how to make a horizon line." Simple answers such as, "Sleepovers are best when all the kids are the same age," or, "We're not sure when Grandpa Mark will be home," open the door a crack. But your curious child will keep pushing at it until you provide more information. While this chapter offers some guidance on common issues and a foundational technique for addressing complex questions, you can take advantage of the many excellent books for children on nearly any touchy or unusual topic. The books are geared to every age and cover a wide spectrum of political and cultural perspectives. Acquire these books by going to a bookstore, not the library. You'll want to keep them around for a long time, since you don't know when the conversational opportunity will strike and then strike again. Don't shop online, because you won't be able to size up the physical attributes of the book. "Too long. Looks like a baby picture book. Print is teeny." Or, "Oh yes, interesting. I want to open this one and dive in." Examine the books for their design, illustrations, and general spirit, as well as for the content. Does your daughter love quizzes? Choose a workbook. Does your son find that humor makes embarrassing topics more appealing and palatable? Find a book with clever cartoon illustrations or one that's written in a breezy style. You'll recognize which will intrigue and which will be rejected for being dull, preachy, or flat-footed. What's sex? What's sexy? And where do babies come from? Here's when children might start asking you about sex. At a younger age than you asked your parents, if you ever did, because kids are exposed to more sex-related media and advertising, billboards with alluring images, and billboards with stern but mysterious health warnings. When mom is pregnant, and they're curious about what caused it to happen, when it will be over and she'll be able to crawl around, jump and play like before, or when and how their new little baby brother or sister will get out of her body. When they want to get the lowdown on the suspicious or true, mom, information Zeke told them at school. Not until fourth or fifth grade, when they are studying plant and animal reproduction and get to wondering about the human version. One reason sex is so mystifying to children is that the word itself has several meanings, and unless they live in a cloistered environment, they'll hear it bandied about often and from an early age. In the book, Sex is a Funny Word by Corey Silverberg and Fiona Smythe, the authors explain that some words always mean the same thing, like sunshine or crayons. Other words have many different meanings, like play. Sex is a word like play. The authors give three definitions of sex, which can be summed up as 1. Sex is a word we use to describe our bodies, like male or female. 2. Sex is something people do together that feels good in their bodies. It also makes them feel close to the other person. Grown-ups call that having sex. 3. Having sex is how grown-ups make babies. Another word for that is reproduction. Children often ask, what's sexy? An impulse might be to launch into a tutorial on what is not. Well, it doesn't mean wearing tons of makeup. Another option is to broaden the child's perspective. You might say, it depends on each person. Sexy is one of those words like wonderful or fun. Almost everyone has a different definition. Sexy can mean that a person thinks someone else is exciting or special, or they make them have good feelings in their body. They might find somebody sexy because of the way the person's hair looks, or their eyes, or they share a sense of humor. The nuts and bolts reproduction questions are harder to finesse. Even if your own parents used baby names for body parts, you'll want to use the real words when talking with your child about sex. Then she'll be prepared if conversations about acceptable and unacceptable touching come up in school or with other children. If it's hard to say vagina or penis out loud, practice on your own, the way you practice a few foreign phrases before a trip. You're entering territory that previously has been somewhat forbidden, if only because parents and teachers do a lot of talking about keeping those specific body parts super clean and super private. Close the door, flush the toilet, wash your hands, don't talk about it in public. Elevating these very same body parts to starring roles in the magical, glorious story of the special hug strikes children as a radical and surprising pivot. Adopt the following explanations as necessary to match your child's age and level of comprehension when the questions arise. Where do babies come from? Our bodies are amazing factories that make cells. When you cut your finger, your body first makes a scab out of cells and new skin forms out of the cells underneath. All cells have specific important jobs. When boys start to become men, their bodies make thousands of sperm cells. These tiny cells have tails like tadpoles to help them swim fast. Girls are born with about 1 million cells called eggs. When girls start becoming women, these egg cells grow just one at a time in her body every month. When a man and a woman cuddle and kiss and hug each other tightly, the man's penis fits into the woman's vagina and lots of sperm cells flow out of his penis and swim toward that egg. When a sperm cell reaches the egg, they join together and start to make all the different kinds of cells that will become a baby. Take a look at the books listed in the recommended reading section in the PDF for answering children's questions about other ways babies come to be. How does the baby get out of the mom? How does it fit? At first, the new bundle of cells is the size of a poppy seed. But it will grow as big as a watermelon in a part of the mom's body called her uterus, which people also call the womb. In the womb, the baby floats in a special sack filled with warm water to protect it from being bumped around and hearing loud sounds. When the baby gets bigger, the uterus stretches like a balloon. It takes 9 months. About as long as a school year, for the baby to get big enough to breathe and drink milk on its own. When the baby is ready to be born, it travels out of the uterus through a tube called the birth canal down to her cervix. Special muscles there can stretch and stretch like a balloon so the baby's big head can pop right out of the mom's vagina. How does the baby eat? Does it poop in there? The baby and the mother are attached to each other by a cord inside the sac. This is called the umbilical cord. To nourish the baby as it grows, the air the mom breathes and the food she eats travel through the cord. Mom eats pizza, baby does too. The stuff the baby doesn't need after it has digested the food, its waste products like your pee and poop, flows right out through this cord. When the baby is born, the umbilical cord comes out too. The doctor, the midwife, or the dad cuts off the cord that attached the baby to the mom, and that cut heals. Your belly button is where your umbilical cord was cut. Follow-up questions and preserving your privacy. When you get to the penis in the vagina part, most children will react with disbelief. Oh, yuck. You and Dad did that? Gross, 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 gross. And after a week or two, did you and Dad do that more than twice? Yet each child is different. While many are initially repelled, some are rapt. Some bored, some excited to share the news. Typically months or years pass before you are invited into a conversation of more depth. There are two responses that are especially helpful with questions about sex. One is, I've thought about it and have some more ideas to add. For example, with an older child, you might want to broaden an answer to include how same-sex couples, single parents, or people who are unable to conceive a baby can have one. The other useful response is, that's not something I share with other people, or I like to keep that private. It's a way to establish and model boundaries with children of any age, including precocious preteen girls who might ask about the first time you had sex, followed by requests for details like your age, your relationship with your partner, the circumstances, or whether or not you were glad. When Ernest parents ask me if they should be entirely transparent with these type of personal questions, I ask if they would feel obligated to answer their child's query about the last time they had sex. Your children are not entitled to any information about your personal sex life you do not wish to share. Puberty and beyond. By age 10 or 11, most children are seeking more detailed facts about sex. It's now normal for children to enter puberty at earlier ages than in previous generations, so they need to be aware of the changes that will be happening with their bodies, emotions, and physical sensations. Some information is straightforward. When girls develop breast buds and a few pubic hairs, they need to start carrying a sanitary pad so they're prepared. This news may be stunning to a young girl, and it's ideal if a mother or another older female can explain it in person with a box of pads on hand so she can demonstrate how to use them. As they move past puberty, teenagers will want to know practical information about sexuality in all its variety and splendor. Few teens want to hear these wonders explained by their mom or dad. Even if you manage to sit them down for 5 minutes while you describe how to put on a condom, their mortification may prevent them from really listening. Instead, hand your child an up-to-date and sensible book about sex and say, "This book explains about body changes, what sex is like, and what it's for. It should answer your questions. But if there's anything you're still curious about, you can ask me, or if you feel shy about it, write me a little note and I'll write back." Your child now has a trustworthy reference to study whenever he or she feels the need, and a willing parent to clarify or expand on ideas. How Love Conquers Porn. Is there any way to completely shield your child from pornography? Nope. Not even if you move off the grid or to North Korea. I say this with deep regret, but it's true. Even young children who are only allowed on carefully vetted playdates can be exposed to these images because someone's got an older sibling with Wi-Fi and a screen, or a homework assignment reveals that WhiteHouse.com is not WhiteHouse.gov, but links to a site where you can view graphic sex videos. Accidental or intentional exposure doesn't mean your child is doomed to expect sex to be as depicted in pornography's alternative universe. Women, they have no hair anywhere but on their heads, and you can do whatever you like with them, be you man, woman, or beast, anytime, and they like it, a lot. It means that in addition to thoughtful books about sex and an open-door policy about technical questions, you'll provide some guidance about self-esteem, tenderness, and love, with an emphasis on the positive. Even books that are up-to-date about gender identity and embracing one's sexual orientation don't typically expound on pleasure, intimacy, and connection. About why adults would want to have sex more than the 2 times it took to create 2 children. One way to transmit values such as respect and loyalty is by the way you treat your child and other family members, modeling love, commitment, warmth, compassion, patience, playfulness, and empathy. You're laying the foundation for physical contact and loving words in a non-sexual way. These are the emotions your child will recognize as normal and familiar in a love relationship when he or she is older. Another way to share these values is through stories of your family history. Recount the tale of how you and your child's other parent got together, if you're still with that person and feeling kindly disposed. How did you know you were in love? Where did you go on your first date? How did you know that person liked you? If this feels too close to oversharing,